Hey folks, this is Michael Shelley and welcome to this week's podcast big show as usual. Of course, J. Vincent Edwards was my guest this week in town for really a Hair-related reunion. And he was in the original London cast of Hair, made a bunch of hit records in the UK in the 60s, and did some other interesting things. We'll talk all about it in this interview. Next week is Mr. Floyd DeKeel, not a household name, but Texas musician who's recorded some of my all-time favorite singles, and then went on, kind of in a garage rock way, and then he went on to play with Louis Prima in his band in the early 70s, I think. We'll find out next week. Of course, Kim Fowley is coming up, a crazy record producer, started with Alley Oop, the Hollywood Argyles, and ended up working with the Byrds and Jonathan Richman and Kiss and Joan, the Runaways, just a long career that goes on and on and on. Richard Goddard, who co-wrote My Boyfriend's Back and I Want Candy and produced albums by folks like Blondie and the Go-Go's and others, still working. He's coming up. Sal Valentino from the Bo Brummels. Did you know that Sly Stone produced their big hit, Laugh Laugh? And an interview with Chris Ife, UK singer whose version of Hush I'm currently crazy about. Anyway, that's all coming up. Check out WFMU.org/Michael to see all the dates and all that. Folks, don't forget, you know, you can listen to the entire 3-hour program, which is packed with hits over at WFMU.org/Michael. There you go. Here is my interview with Mr. J. Vincent Edwards.
She flies like a bird in the sky.
It's a beautiful song, a fantastic version there. J. Vincent Edwards, can't let Maggie go. I think he is on the telephone joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to New York.
What a fantastic set of songs we just heard there. Really kind of uplifting and made me feel good.
That's the only way to feel on a cold Saturday morning.
Yeah, a little bit of a surprise for you. Well, you come in from the UK, not exactly known for, you know, warm weather.
We got some sunshine there today, I think, and I flew in from Frankfurt, Germany, and it was fairly warm, but who cares?
Where do you live? Where do you reside these days?
I live in the south of Germany at the moment, in a little town called Ulm.
Why do you live there?
Oh, that's a long, long story. I lived in London for 40 years, and my wife is German, and we just went back to look after her parents when they got old.
Fair enough. Let's go the other way. Where were you born?
I'm a Geordie. I'm from Newcastle upon Tyne, England.
And how far is that from London? How does it relate to London?
It's 300 miles north.
So it's
where the animals come from.
Culturally. So growing up, what was the music scene there? What were you listening to? What were your folks listening to?
Blues. Total blues. Oh, growing up, they were listening to Guy Mitchell and people like Frankie Lane. And then when I started having my skiffle, I had a skiffle group. Do you know the music skiffle?
Yeah, something that anyone could play in a washboard bass and Lonnie Donegan and folk songs.
That's it, yeah. It's when most of the English groups, they started off the working class boys by joining and forming skiffle groups. And you could play a T-chest bass and a washboard and have one guitar. And I think that's what got everybody interested in music. Even the Beatles had a skiffle group before they put their band together, the Quarrymen. I think they were a skiffle.
Right. I think in America we don't quite understand the significance of skiffle in terms of the sensation.
Yes.
Lonnie Donegan and those folks started over there.
And that all came after, and Lonnie Donegan was into Woody Guthrie and... So it was all sort of folksy, bluesy music, and we played it because it was so simple, and we could learn three chords on a guitar. And from that on, we sort of went into rock bands, and then into Chuck Berry and Little Richard, and stuff like that. Eddie Cochran.
So we heard from The Answers, "Just a Fear." That record, I think, is 1966, right?
That's right, The Answers. Yeah, we were from Newcastle, and that was our first recording on Columbia Records.
And how did that band get signed? How did you start
turning it from playing around town, I guess, to a serious gig. Let's get signed. Let's get a record out.
It was the fault of the Beatles, really, because when they burst on the scene, and about 100 bands from Liverpool came on the scene, and then bands from Manchester, like the Hollies, started coming on the scene, and somebody said, it's got to be something coming out of Newcastle. So the Animals were playing up there, and we were playing there, and the Animals, Chas Chandler was a great, great friend of mine. I used to work with him in the shipyards when I was 15 years old. And so they come looking, the agents and record companies would tour around the north of England looking for bands. And someone saw us playing in a cellar club and invited us down to London to make a record. It was just like that.
Amazing. And that song, The Answers, is that a song that the group wrote?
Yeah, there's a wonderful guitar player we had called Tony Hill. And Tony was about 19 at the time. He wrote the song. And he went on to play in a group that was half English, half American called Misunderstood. Hmm. They were a psychedelic group. So absolutely fantastic. But they broke up in about the 70s. And so we were starting to write our own songs around about that time. Prior to that, we would sing old Chuck Berry songs and Jimmy Reed and T-Bone Walker and Smokey Robinson, The Miracles, and stuff like that.
That's a very heavy record. I mean, was that what the band sounded like live?
Yeah, we were probably the second loudest band in the world. The Who were the loudest. And we were very, very loud indeed. And it's amazing because we were about 19 or 20 years old at the time. We had so much energy. All the energy came out there. We made that record in about 15 minutes.
I was about to ask that. Yeah, that's amazing. So you just went in, set up, and knocked it out, basically.
Yeah, but how we actually did it, we were doing a gig up north the night before. And our van broke down about 100 miles north of London. It was about 3 in the morning. And we got a call into London into a club called the Bag of Nails, where our manager was at the time, Jimmy Duncan. And he was sitting with Donovan and Jimi Hendrix. And he got Jimi Hendrix's car and Donovan's road manager, Gypsy Dave, to drive up the M1 and tow us back to London so we could get there in time to make this record. And we actually picked up a ticket for speeding.
Being towed?
Yeah.
Wow.
We'd never gone that fast ever. No. Oh, Gypsy Dave was a great driver, and he had this big American car belonging to Jimi Hendrix, because everybody used to share everything in those days. You know, you just pass around what you had. And he towed us down to London, and we arrived about 8 in the morning. He went straight in the studio, and no sleep, anything, and knocked out Just the Fear. That's probably why it sounds a bit manic.
That's crazy, yeah. So tell me, I mean, you sort of... Everybody who talks about that scene, you know, the mid-60s, talks about it like it was one big, never-ending party.
It was a party, but it wasn't just a happy party. I mean, you had to find food, and you had to find places to sleep. We all lived in Notting Hill in London, and all had little flats and apartments, and if one group couldn't pay their rent, they'd move in with another group. And we were all pretty helped each other. Because we were all in the same boat.
Yeah. So what did a gig pay you?
If you were lucky, you probably got about £30.
To split between the bands.
And then the agent would get a cut out of that. And you had to wait for your money, so you might not get it either.
So, okay, the Answers dissolve and you decide to become a solo artist? Is that what happened?
Yeah. Someone saw us doing gigs and approached me from United Artists Records. I'd become a solo artist, and we were thinking of splitting up because we'd just done a gig with the Yardbirds on a big festival, and they were just so ahead of us. They had two lead guitar players, and it was so fantastic. So I really wanted to start a soul band with some brass, and Tony, our guitar player, just wanted to continue with his psychedelic, and God bless him, he's still doing it. And I went solo and signed a contract for United Artists Records and put a band together with four saxophones. And we used to do the clubs around London. And it was a little bit like Chris Farlow and the Thunderbirds, mm-hmm. Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames, Alan Price, sort of that type of soulist stuff. And that went on till Hair came along. The musical Hair arrived in London in 68. I went and auditioned for that, sang Aquarius, and got the part singing Aquarius.
We heard a bunch of your singles. They were all, I think, released on UA sort of in between that time. Now, did you know about Hair, the songs? Had you recorded any of your versions of those things before you actually auditioned?
That's a great question, because what happens, my bass player out of the Answers, after the Answers broke up, a guy called Bob Calder, fantastic bass player, as you probably hear on the It's Just a Fear record, he became the road manager for the Bee Gees. And he went to America with the Bee Gees, who were managed by Robert Stigwood. And Robert Stigwood bought some of the rights of Hair, because it just started at the Biltmore Theater in New York in 68. And Bob, when he came back to England, he brought me a demo tape of the song Aquarius. He says, you've got to record this. I don't know if the show's ever going to come to London, but it's perfect for your voice. So this was the song I took to United Artists before Hair had actually arrived in London. And they actually published the music as well. So they thought, well, the show is never going to be a hit. So let's make the record. The record's good. Let's record it. So when auditions came along for Hair in London, there was about 3,000 people turned up to audition, including David Bowie and Paul Jones and a whole bunch of people. And they were singing songs from other shows. And I came on, and the piano player who was auditioning says, what do you want to sing? I said, I'll sing Aquarius. And he said, how does it go? And the three writers were sitting in the front row watching, and Galt McDermott shouted, you know Aquarius? I said, yeah. So he came on stage and he played piano. I sang it. He said, can you try this song as well? What a Piece of Work Is Man. And I sang it. He says, right, you're in. So I was the first guy that signed for Hair, because I was just slightly ahead of the game, knowing the song Aquarius.
And I mean, that moment changed your life, I guess, forever.
Absolutely.
Here we are 40 years later, and we're still, you know,
we're still talking about it.
And it's still very relevant somehow.
Yeah, it's the Love and Peace musical, and the movements, and it just let me know what the real values of life are about, you know, about kindness and being nice to other people and not caring about money, but helping people and being nice. That's still today. We've got this big party tonight, and it's just going to be a loving, so beautiful.
Yeah, that's why you're in town. It's the 40th anniversary reunion and celebration of Tom O'Horgan's birthday, which is 80-something, right?
God bless Tom. Yeah, he's May the 3rd. His 84th birthday, the great Tom O'Horgan. He's so, so beautiful. He's my guru.
Huh. It's tonight at Synod House at the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine, 7:30 to 11:30, and that's 110th Street in Amsterdam Dam Avenue up by Columbia. Yeah.
Should be a lovely night, yeah. But especially to see Tom again. And
there's people coming from all different casts, from all different times.
Yes, I met a guy last night at dinner who actually put Hair on in Russia. At the time, he was the producer. And he ran it in the late 60s in Russia. And he's over here, and people are coming over from France and from Australia, and anybody who has something to do with one of the Hair casts.
That sounds like it's going to be a riot.
Yeah, and there's about 6 or 7 people over from England. Andy Ferrer, who's an American guy, he's here in New York. He was in the English cast. He recorded a couple of records with the Diamond label before he came to England. And Paul Nicholas, who is now a producer, he produces Grease, I think, on Broadway. He's here also from the English cast. So it's like meeting our families again. So beautiful.
You talk about the message of Hair, but the undeniable catchiness of the music,
yes.
You know, is yeah. Without that, I don't know if folks would have gotten the message.
The music was absolutely, and still is, fantastic. Yeah, I think you had to actually go and see Hair 50, 60, 100 times to really get into the message of it. But once you heard one of those songs, was with you forever.
Yeah, you know, my parents, it was one of those LPs that they had and just listened to in a big stack over and over. So it's a record I heard a million times in my childhood, and those songs are just part of that time. They're linked to that time. When people want to illustrate what those days were about in the late 60s, they always link that music to whatever. So how long did it play in London?
It played in London for 5 years till the roof fell in at the Shaftesbury Theatre.
Literally.
Yeah, it is. And I played the first 18 months because I opened the show on the opening night, singing Aquarius. But after about a year, we had a hole in the roof already. And I remember one night we were singing Let the Sunshine In to end the show. And it was actually snowing. And snow was coming through onto the audience. And it was so beautiful coming down through the lights. It was just a total magic moment. So beautiful.
That's amazing.
And these magic moments always happen around the show. Things just absolutely incredible.
After that, I guess the early 70s, it seems like you were sort of a pop star, what they call a pop star in England.
Yeah, yeah, what happened? The Hollies came to see me, and they asked me to join them when Graham Nash left. And so I went and I did a couple of songs with them on Hollies sing Bob Dylan, Blown in the Wind, and This Wheel's on Fire. And I think that the lead singer, the next album they were going to do was the Hollies sing Motown. And I think the lead singer, Alan Clark, was a little bit worried in case I might have been singing lead on that. And he voted me out of the group, so I didn't join.
They got Terry Sylvester.
Yeah, and then funny enough, Alan left straight after, and they were a little bit too embarrassed to come back and ask me
how
to join.
Interesting. Well, that would have been a great match.
Yes, it would have been. In fact, when we actually made the records, we didn't sound like the Hollies. We sounded more like Hall & Oates, which was nice going into the next stage.
Interesting.
But that was nice. But so at the same time, Richard Harris, the actor, saw me in here, and he signed me up. He became my manager.
Really?
Yeah, and that's how I signed to CBS Records through Richard and made those records on CBS. That was the pop star bit.
Yeah, and there's some great clips on YouTube I urge folks to take a peek at of J. Vincent Edwards singing in pop star mode.
Oh, right. Yeah, you've seen some of those, yeah.
Yeah, they're great. Tell me about Jimmy Webb. He crosses your path somewhere along the line.
Oh, Jimmy, my brother, my soul brother. Well, Jimmy was also signed to Richard Harris because Jimmy did a whole album.
Right.
Richard, you know, with MacArthur Park and some beautiful, beautiful songs. And Jimmy was only 19 at the time. So Richard introduced Jimmy to me, and we got on great. We played tennis every day, and we just had lots of beer to drink and stuff like that. Young kids, what to do. And he gave me some songs to sing. I ended up recording Didn't We Girl, which is on the Thanks album, and Highwayman. And we just became friends for life. And every album that I ever recorded, I always would record a Jimmy Webb song on it. And Jimmy's still doing fine. He does a one-man show, and he's just the greatest songwriter in the world ever.
Yeah, very special songwriter.
Yeah, and a beautiful, beautiful person.
And one of those guys that managed to sort of capture the zeitgeist of the times in those songs, you know, which is hard to do. You talked about the Beatles. Tell me, just, I always wonder, you know, for folks who had to make records when the Beatles were making records, was there a weird pressure, or was there a weird, let's listen to their record and you know, see if it influences us?
Yeah, well, the Beatles were the highest. They were top of the league, but if there was maybe the Animals might have had a song out, or the Searchers, or the Swinging Blue Jeans, or the Yardbirds, or the Who. So you said, maybe we should go that style or that way. There was not just go after the Beatles sound, and then somehow you had a little bit of all the sounds, and you developed your own sound somehow. Every group sounded different.
Records sounded better for sure. You made some records with Chris Ife.
Oh, Chris, my good buddy, Chris Ife. He's from a group called The Quiet Five, he started out in. But I met Chris when I was writing songs for an American publisher called Aaron Schroeder. And he had a school. He set up a school a little bit like the Brill Building. And he tried to get all the English writers at the time to come and write songs together. So I met Chris at these meetings, and we hit it off very, very quickly. And he was a fantastic, well, he still is a fantastic singer. He recorded Joe South's version of Hush.
Right, you hipped me to that a few weeks ago when we played it on the show. It really is an amazing thing. And you guys made these records together that have a very unusual sound.
Yeah, we were both signed to different record companies. So somehow we winged it. We called ourselves Jackson and Jones. And we recorded some songs for the Polydor label.
Yeah, why, Jackson and Jones, just sort of It's Not Us type of pseudonym?
Yeah, that's a pseudonym, yeah.
Yeah,
for Chris Ife and Vincent Edwards, yeah.
Very interesting. And
they were pretty powerful songs.
Yeah, they really are. They remind me of those English brothers.
The Walker Brothers.
The Walker Brothers, yeah.
Well, we were more into Bill Medley and Bobby Hatfield.
Ah.
We loved them dearly.
English version of that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, since then, you've lived in Germany for a while. You've written a musical, Souls, that Tom O'Horgan worked on with you, right?
That's right, up at La Mama Theatre.
You've done some television work. What else are you doing? What else is coming up?
Well, I'm still writing songs because, you know, I wrote the song Right Back Where We Started From.
Right.
For Maxine Nightingale. And I think they just featured it on Pop Idol about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, American Idol?
Yeah, they had the whole cast singing it. So the song's still around, and it's just gone into another movie called College Road Drive. There's a new movie just came out, an American movie. So it's in about 8 or 9 movies. And I'm still writing all the time and trying to help young kids into the business without them getting scalded. and generally having fun.
Yeah, that sounds great. I want to remind the folks you're in town for this 40th anniversary Hair Alumni Reunion and Tom O'Horgan's birthday celebration. That's tonight, the Sanad House. It's at the corner of 110th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, 7:30 p.m. Are there tickets? Do you know what the deal is?
There were tickets. I don't know if they've all gone or you get tickets at the door, but
folks,
you've got to bring your caftans and your beads.
And it's just going to be a performance and a celebration?
I'm not even sure what it's going to be. It's just going to be a loving, a being.
Well, you don't get too many of those nowadays.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Let's start it all again, you know, 40 years on.
I have that song queued up right back where we started from.
I
thought of that song, and it's a song I've heard, you know, a million times probably,
yeah.
And I thought, oh, it's a disco song. And then I listened to it, and it's not a disco song at all.
No.
Somehow I thought it was a disco song, I guess just because it's a danceable song. It seems to me almost like a bubblegum song.
Yeah, whatever it is, the words are probably more bubblegum, but we I'm very, very influenced by Motown, and I just loved Holland, Dozier Holland, anything they've done. I'd kiss their feet, these guys, or the Temptations, or the Four Tops, and my style somehow came a little bit like theirs, my writing style.
Yeah, it does have that sort of that beat that is just very Motown-y, that undeniable, hit you over the head, no ignoring it.
Yeah,
style.
I was very lucky, and it came out in America, and I think it went right up to 1 or 2.
I think it was number one. How did you get in business with Maxine Nightingale, and how did this song evolve?
Well, Maxine was also in the musical Hair.
Oh, okay.
And there was another writing partner that I have called Pierre Tubbs. He was working for United Artists. He'd produced a couple of records with me before. And he came up with the title, Right Back Where We Started From. He says, have you got anything that fits this title? I've got a great singer. And I wrote it on the dashboard of his car while we were going to the hospital because his wife was having a baby at Hammersmith Hospital. So we wrote it in about 7 minutes.
So just humming and making up words and writing it down.
Just writing it off Pierre's title. Give me the title and the rest just flowed. And I'd already had all that Motown ideas going through my head for the last 10 years before that. And we went in the studio the very next day, went in the next studio again, and it was out within 2 weeks. It was top in England and then in the States. It was just, wherever it went, it was a hit.
Who plays on the record?
Pete Kircher, my good friend, you know, the drummer from Honeybus.
Oh, right. Okay, great.
He plays on everything he's a smashing lad, he is, Pete. And he used to play with Status Quo after.
Oh, okay.
He's done a lot of Status Quo songs. And I think he's retired now, I'm not sure. But he's still around. He'll be doing something. And Pete played in Dave Robry from The Animals, the rhythm section. And Pierre Tubbs played guitar, and I played some percussion on it. And then we found a chap who did the orchestrations, the guy who did the Electric Light Orchestra, Wilf Gibson. So we had the Electric Light Orchestra bass player on it also. And we just gelled. It just fell into place.
It's such a fantastic number one hit record. It's just like, when you heard it, did you think, okay, this is going to be a hit?
Not really, because I got offered the thing to do I could have done a double act with Maxine. It could have been Maxine and Vincent's singing the song. And at the same time, I got approached by Private Stock Records to record a Jimmy Webb song called The Worst That Could Happen. Girl, I've heard you getting married.
Right.
So I said, okay, Martin, you do that song, and I'll go with Private Stock and do The Worst That Could Happen. And it was the worst that could happen. And but it was just how it was then. Everything was moving so fast.
Yeah.
So fast. It was, so Maxine got away with it, which is beautiful. And she's still performing it today. And she's still beautiful as she ever was. And she's all over the world performing this song. She does shows and... Wonderful.
Sure, I'm sure you gave her a career. Literally, I mean, I'm sure a song like this, without being too crass, you know, you must get a nice income every year. Just, you know, some checks come in the mail.
It's if you have two or three of those, you have your pension scheme, you know. But for me, it's just nice to see what new thing it's gone into. If it's gone into a new movie or if someone... new has recorded it.
Yeah.
What type of how it sounds, and that interests me. And if the money's going to come, it'll find its own way to you after everybody's took a share. You know.
Well, it's an amazing story to go sort of from the 300 miles away from the center of the action to Skiffle to this sort of psychedelic group, The Answers, to your early solo work and your hair work and your pop work, and then Maxine Nightingale. It's really
It's
a good story. Yeah. All right, well, let's hear this record. Jay Vincent Edwards, thanks for visiting with us. And
urge
folks to check out the 40th anniversary celebration tonight. I have a feeling you will have a great time there.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you very much for your interview.
Ah, pleasure. Let's keep in touch.
You're a fantastic show. I listen to you every week, by the way.
That's very sweet of you.
On the computer.
That's great. All right, bon voyage, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. God bless.
Thank you.
Bye.